We'll start now on the end of Samach Dalet Amud Beis with Tanoihi, the last three words on the Amud. We discuss the case of someone who goes out with a zug. He's got a bell that's plugged up on his donkey, and it's prohibited, according to the Braisa, because of Maris Ayin. People will think that he's leading his donkeys to the marketplace and he's going to sell them, because that's the way they used to adorn the animals for the market, make them more attractive in the market. And the Braisa recorded a machlokes whether or not we could allow the donkey to go out into a chatzer with a bell. And that really reflects the fundamental machlokes about the scope and the application of Maris Ayin. How far do we go? In a case of a chatzer, it's a private area surrounded by mechitzos. No one's going to see that he's got these bells on his donkeys, and no one will be choshed him that he's going to the market. But yet, according to one sheet in the Tanoim, it's Osur. Tanoihi, the Gemara says that this really reflects a general machlokas Tanoim, Disanya, Shotchan Bechama, Avalo Keneged Ha'am. Let's see, he has wet clothes that got soaked with rain, for example, and he wants to Shotchan. Shotchan means to spread them out. And in the sun, to dry. So the Tanakama here says that that's allowed if you do it in a private place, avalo keneged ha'am, but not in a place where people could see it, because that gives them the appearance as if he had washed these clothes on Shabbos. Somebody might suspect him. And Rabbi Lazar, Rabbi Shimon Osrim, according to the second sheet in this Braisa, even in a case of a secluded area and there's no public eye, nevertheless, it's usur, because they're of the opinion that whenever we prohibit something under the law of Maris Ayin, it's usur even bechadre chadorim. So we see that the Braisa that we learnt before, recording a machlokas about going out in a chatzer, in a private place, with a donkey that has a bell on it, that machlokas is really a machlokas tanoim with regard to whether or not you're allowed to shake and spread out wet clothing to dry on Shabbos in a secluded area. Do we apply the principle that Maris Ayin is also even in a private area, even bechadre chador? So after wishing you a Shavuot Tov, we're on Daf Samach Hey Amud Aleph, which is today's Daf, and we're on the two dots, which is three lines down from the top of the page. The Mishnah says that Moch Sheba Ozno, Moch, the word Moch, which we use today is referring to cotton, but it means any kind of a soft substance that you put somewhere in order to clog it up or to absorb liquid that you want to get rid of. So in the case of ozen, if you have some liquids that come out of your ear, this is somewhat typical of older people, so she's allowed to put this into her ear and go out with Rishus HaRabim. And Toni Rami Bar Yechezkel, according to the Braisa, Husha Kosher Bi Ozna, this is only permissible if it's tied down. In other words, it's really very securely fastened in such a way that we're not afraid that that it's something that she's carrying. It's really, in a sense, attached to her body in a semi-permanent way. Ubimoch shesandola, and the Mishnah allows you to put again some sort of a soft cushioning kind of material substance into your sandal, into your shoe, because that again becomes part of the shoe. Tani Rami Bar Yechezkel, again, consistently, Vahu Shekoshula B'Sandala. Now, it's this piece of let's say it might be leather or whatever it might be that you place into the sandal, has to be attached in a permanent way. We're always afraid of something that's an addendum, that's not really part of the lavush, part of the body or the clothing that you're wearing, and something that might fall and you might come to pick it up and carry it. So it's got to be there in a secure way. And also this kind of a cotton substance or whatever kind of a substance that she uses to receive and absorb the dam nida, that's also okay. And the question is, does she have to tie this down? Like we saw before in the two cases of putting some stuffing into your ear or into your shoe, Sava Rami Bar Chamal Meimar, Rami thought to say, V'hushek Shura La Bein Yericho Seha. It's got to be really tied down between her thighs. In other words, we're afraid that it might fall. Amar Rava, Rava disagrees, and he says, Afal Pisha Eino Kosher La. In this case, even if in the worst case scenario it might fall off, because it's not tied down securely, nevertheless it's mutter. Why? We're not afraid that if it falls off, she'll pick it up and carry it home. Kevan de mois, since it's repulsive, it's got a an absorption of dam nida in it, lo asya lasuye. She's not going to pick it up and carry it for amos in Rishus HaRab. Maybe this is something that she'll leave behind. I don't know about the signs on the side that say "do not litter." I don't know that. I can't figure out. Anyway, boy mine Rabbi Yirmiya mi Rabbi Abba. Asa sala beis yad mahu. Let's say this pad that she puts in order to collect her dam nida has a handle to it. In which case, if it falls off, it's very easy for her to pick it up. And also, the fact that she bothered to add a handle to it might mean that it's she put some effort into it. She wants to take it home. She doesn't want to just leave it there. Amalei mutter. So Rabbi Abba said, even in this case, it's mutter, because it still remains something disgusting, and she's not going to want to take it home, even though it has a base yad. Itmar nami, and we support this with a price. Omar Rav Nachman Bar Oshem Rav Yochanan. Okay, this is not really a brisa, but it goes all the way back to Rav Yochanan. Asa sola beis yad mutter. Even though she put a handle on, and it's a little bit easier for her to touch this and carry this pad, even without touch, you know, coming direct contact with the absorbent part of the pad. But nevertheless, it's still mutter. We consider it as something that's not worth it for her in event that it falls off, that she would actually carry it home to Rishus HaRab. Now the Gemara tells us two stories, very similar, about these different wads that you put into your ear. And we see the following. We had a brisa of Rami Bar Yecheskel that it's not always the case that this is mutter to go out in Rishus HaRabim with this stuffing in your ear. It has to be really tied down securely. And yet, Rabbi Yochanan, Nafik Bey LeBey Midrasha, when he left his house on the way to the base Medrash, and apparently he went through a Rishus HaRabim, he had this wad of whatever it was to receive and absorb the guk in his ear, he had it in his ear. V'chalukim olav chaverov, but his colleagues did not agree with him. A similar story, but a major difference. Rav Yanai nofik behu. Rav Yanai also went out of his house wearing this kind of a stuffing in his ear, but it was lekarmelis. He didn't go out to Rishus HaRabim. He went into a place that's pretty much open. It doesn't have mechitzos. It's very similar to Rishus HaRabim. It's accessible to the public, but nevertheless, it doesn't have shishim ribui. It's not something that is part of the highway of the city. And the Rabbanan prohibited carrying in a karmelis, but it's only the Rabbanan. And nevertheless, despite the fact that it's only Derabbanan, Chalukim Olav Koldoro, the members of his generation rejected this idea, and they disagreed. because they felt that a Carmelis has the same status, although Midrabanan, as a Rishus HaRabim. And therefore, whatever is prohibited in a Rishus HaRabim, ipso facto, is prohibited in a Carmelis. So although Rabbi Yanai was not willing to go as far as Rabbi Yochanan, it seems, to wear it in Rishus HaRabim, but he would be Mekil and be lenient in Carmelis. And he has a certain attractive, compelling logic, because the whole business about this not being secure and maybe it'll fall, etc., etc., that's all a Gzeira D'Rabbanon, and a Carmelis itself is a Gzeira D'Rabbanon. So that far we don't go. Now the Gemara is going to ask a kash on Rabbi Yochanan, because Rabbi Yochanan went all the way into Rishus HaRabim. V'atani Rami Bar Chama, what does Rabbi Yochanan do with the Braisa that specifies that V'husha Kosha L'Biyazna, that it's got to be tied down, and Rabbi Yochanan was not tied down. So the Gemara says, Lo Kasha, Ha De Mehedek V'Ha De Lo Mehedek. It all depends on how you put this this thing to clog up your ear. Do you tie it down tightly or do you not? So Rabbi Yochanan tied it down tightly, and therefore it was mutter. Okay. Now the Mishnah says that there are all sorts of herbs and different kinds of food that you put in your mouth simply because it gives a better smell to the mouth. It's kind of like even today people will suck different kinds of sucking candies that are given for the purpose of a better odor in the mouth. And the Mishnah says that amongst the list of things that she's allowed to take out into Rishus HaRabim is bepilpel uvegalgel melach. So the word galgel is a round lump. Pilpel is a kind of a spice. And melach, of course, is salt. So these are different things that are helpful in the mouth. Pilpel. The case of pilpel is l'reach ha-peh, is very good for the breath, to give a very nice, appealing odor to the breath. And galgil melach is l'darshine. Rashi identifies darshine as a kind of an infection in the tooth, which perhaps also is painful. Maybe it also gives a certain bad odor. And these are considered part of the body because you have them in your mouth in order to improve, whether it's the situation of your bad odor in your body, or maybe perhaps you have a certain toothache. Again, there's a question here about refuah B'Shabbos. Why is this permissible in the case especially of melach? It would seem that this is a refuah, and perhaps the answer to that is that it's not a refuah that has to be produced, you know, with different ingredients that have to be crushed together. It's something that exists in nature, and something that exists in its natural state is not called a refuah. Like, for example, the Gemara allows you to gargle with olive oil or different kinds of oils that might help your throat, even though you're doing it for therapeutic purposes. But the oil is in its natural state. Then the Mishnah says, Kol davar shenitan letoch piha. The Mishnah gives you a general rule that whatever she puts into her mouth, and apparently the Mishnah didn't want to go into all details enumerating every single thing that's helpful for the mouth, and it gave you this generic kind of statement, and the Gemara kind of analyzes what could we include in this kol davar of the Mishnah. So one example is called zangebila, otherwise known as ginger. Inami, another example is dartsona, which is cinnamon. And all these things have a very important function, whether it's for healing or again to give her a good breath, and we're not afraid that she's going to take it out of her mouth, show it to a friend, and start carrying it. So if it does have the status of a lavush, meaning something that's attached to the body, and this in this case for therapeutic purposes, then we're not afraid on a derabbanan level that maybe she'll take it out of her mouth in order to show it off. Now what about a case of a woman who lost a tooth, her natural tooth, and it was replaced, the dentist replaced it with a false tooth, and is there a difference between what material was used for this false tooth? So it says, Shein Tosefes, Shein Shel Zahav. Okay, so we have a false tooth that's made of gold. Rabbi Meir Matir, V'chachomim Osrim. According to Rabbi Meir, a woman would be inhibited to take out her false tooth and show off the beautiful gold because that's embarrassing. The Chachomim say no, she might do it anyway. We have to be very careful. Well, Rabbi Zera Lo Shanu, this machlokas only applies Shel Zav, a very valuable piece of gold that's in your mouth. Aval Shel Kesef, silver apparently was very common. And if you weren't a rich person and you had to have a false tooth, then you'd get a silver tooth. Is Diriyah called Mut? And nobody would agree, argue about this because we're not afraid that she would show off a silver tooth and take it out of her mouth. She might possibly do so in the case of a gold tooth. Tanya Namihochi, you have a brisa to support this distinction between silver and gold. Bishal Kesef Divya Kol Mutter. Everybody agrees that in the case of a false tooth that is made of silver, it's Mutter. She's not going to show it off to anyone else. Bishal Zav Rebbe Matir V'Chachomim Osrim. Here we have a machlokes between Rebbe and the Chachomim. Omar Abaye. Now Abaye wants to present three different tanoim in three different cases, and they all actually embody or manifest this principle, this halachic principle, that when a person will be embarrassed by showing something off, then you're allowed to take it out to a reshus harabim, as long as it's a garment, a lavush. Who are these three Tanoim? There's Rebbe, Rabbi Eliezer, and Reb Shimon ben Elazar. Kulu Sfirle, they all agree, L'chol Mili de Meganyobe, anything that would be embarrassing to take out and show, Lo Asi, it won't come, L'achvuye, to carry it in Rosh Hashanah. Rebbe, that's the first of the three, Hoda Moran. Rebbe allowed her to wear her gold tooth in Rishus HaRabim. She's not going to take it off and show it to anybody. Rabbi Eliezer, where's Rabbi Eliezer? Desanya, Rabbi Eliezer poter b'choveles uvetzluchas shel flaiton. You may remember that we spoke about various kinds of pendants that are hollow, and inside she puts something that might give her a good smell, like spice or balsam, which is very fragrant. And all this is worn by a woman who unfortunately suffers from bad body odor. So this is her deodorant. And Rabbi Eliezer claims that she'd be too embarrassed to take this off and show it to anybody, because that would be publicly admitting that she suffers from body odor. Rav Shimon Elazar, that's the third on the list, the Sanya Klalam or Rav Shimon Elazar, Kol Shu Lamata Min Asvacha Yotzaba. Anything that she wears below her head, I'm sorry, below her hat, and if she were to take it off, it would expose her hair, that's Mutter. But Lamala Min Asvacha Eina Yotzaba. But if she adorns her hat by adding something on top, that's prohibited. because she could remove it from her hat, unless it's sewn on permanently, and show it to someone without exposing her hair. So we have three Tanoim, all reflect this basic common denominator, this underlying principle that if there's a level of embarrassment, we're not afraid that she would take it off, and therefore it's Mutar Rishus HaRabim. And now we start the Mishnah for today. Now, in this Mishnah, we're going to talk a little bit about medicinal procedures and things that a woman might add to her body for the sake of healing a wound. And again, it's a little bit strange to our ears, but Yotza Besela Sha'alatzinis. If a woman is suffering from some sort of a wound, we'll see in a minute exactly what tzinis is, but she would put a sela, a certain kind of a coin, very hard substance that had a chosam on it, it had an engraving on it, and that somehow was medicinal. It not only protected her wound from being exposed, but also healed her wound, and that's mutter. She would never take that off because it really is necessary for her well-being. Now, the Mishnah goes on to talk about young girls that they used to pierce their ears when they were young. Obviously, they didn't do it themselves, but the parents had done. And then they wouldn't start wearing earrings at a young age. They would put something into the hole in order to make sure that it didn't close up. So the Mishnah says, Habonos ktanos yotzos bechutin. And these threads were placed inside the hole of her ear, v'afilu bikisamin, and they used to even use some sort of a small piece of wood, shebazneim, and they would pass it through the holes of their ears. Now the Mishnah goes on to say that there are various kinds of levushim, kinds of garments dresses that women would wear that were reflective of that particular society that they came from. And here the question is, if let's say a woman would dress in a different country, in a different society, with the way that they would dress in that society, would that be permissible? So for example, Arvios Yotzos Reulos. Reulos means when you cover your face. And apparently in Arabia back in the day, to some extent I think it's even true today, they used to wrap their faces in a kind of a cloth for modesty reasons. And if that's the way they dress, then that's accepted malbush. Another example is madios in madai, prufos. They used to have a certain kind of a, almost like a cape or so, that they would throw over their shoulder, and they would, in order to fasten it, make sure that it didn't open, they would add a little stone into a hole. And they would, the stone would hang, or a nut or something, and then they would fasten it by putting it into that hole. Again, this is going to be a problem to do on Shabbos, but if she did it on Erev Shabbos, and that's the way she's wearing, she can go out into Rishus HaRabim. V'chol Adam. Now the Mishnah claims that these various cases of special kinds of national cultural dress habits would be acceptable and permissible for anyone. You don't have to be in Arabia or in Madai. It's always permissible. So then why did the Chachamim say Arvios Yotzos, Madios Pum, El Dibru Chachom Behov? The Mishnah is expressing itself in the most common way. And then we have Porefes al Oven. It's interesting, until now we spoke about using these kinds of bimkom, replacement buttons. And now we're talking about, in this case, a stone, which is normally mukta, but here it was set for a purpose in order to use it as a button to fasten an article of clothing. V'ala egos, v'ala matbea, Now, it's interesting. The Mishnah is talking about a coin. A coin, again, would classically be mukta, but in this case, since it was designated for the purpose of a function as a button to fasten an article of clothing, therefore, it's mutter. But she's not allowed to fasten these things on Shabbos itself, and that we'll see exactly why. So first of all, we go back to the beginning of the Mishnah. The Mishnah talks about sela, which is a certain coin that she would place on the tzinis. So my tzinis, bas ara. This is a wound, in this case, on the sole of her foot. And if she has such a wound, the coin is therapeutic. So the Gemara says, Maishna sela. What is it? If she wants to protect this wound, why a coin? Ilema, if you're going to tell me, kol midi da kusha ma'alile, for her purposes, all she needs is something akusha. Kusha means lashon kasha. It's hard. It's protective. Is then liavidle chaspa. Why don't she take a piece of earthenware? And that's also hard. That also could protect her. Why a sela? Why this coin? Elamishum shuchsa. Apparently, the advantage of a coin is that that it has some sort of moisture to it. I don't know the physics of it. If somebody wants to research this and let me know, but apparently it creates a moist, it's not only hard, but it's also moist. So the Gemara asks, Lievedle Tasa, why can't she take a piece of silver and flatten it, and it would make it into a plate, and that would cover the wound? Apparently that would be enough to give her the moisture that she needs. Elamishum tsursa. There's a tsura on this coin. The coins, as they are today, back in the day, were also stamped with a certain image. They were minted coins. And the Gemara says that if somehow the mint on the coin, the image on the coin, is therapeutic, is lievid le pulsa. She could fashion out of a piece of wood a flat surface and etch an image on it. So the Gemara says, Amar Abaye Shmamina Kulu Malin La. The sela has all the advantages, A, B, and C. It's an overlap of three elements that are therapeutic. Number one, it has the hardness, which we saw you could also achieve with a chaspa. Number two, it has moisture, which we said perhaps you can achieve with a tasa. And number three, it has the advantage of a graven image on it, which you could also achieve with a pulsa. But there's no one single item that has the overlap of A, B, and C. It has hardness, moisture, and a graven image. And therefore the sela is the one specified object that would be perfect to heal her wound. Anything else that she uses was not accepted at that time. It wasn't customary to use any of the other alternative candidates, and therefore they become a masa, and she's not allowed to wear that in Rishus Aram. Now we talk about the young girls with pierced ears. Habanas Yotzos Bechutin, Avud Ishmuel, Lo Shavaklu, Libnase, Denafke Bechutin. So now we're going to learn about Avud Ishmuel and a number of his, I would call them almost chumros, you know, strict customs that he accepted upon himself, and he behaved in a very specific way, and all of them, all three of them, are vis-a-vis his young girls. First of all, he was machmir not to allow them to wear these threads in their ears. And we'll see why in a second, even though the Mishnah allows it, but Avud Ishmuel did not allow it for his daughters. Number two, and this is going to be the most complicated of today's discussion, which we'll get to very soon. Ovid lehu mikvos biyomei Nisan. Now, just a little bit of background. Again, I'm going to give more of a background in about 3 minutes, but just to touch on the surface of it, normally, in those areas of Bavel that bordered on the Euphrates River, anyone who had to go to mikveh would go into the river. But there are certain months of the year when the river was overflowing because of the rains that had fallen during the course of the winter, culminating in the month of Nisan, and Avud Shmuel would not permit his daughters to go into the river as a mikveh. And we'll see why. Umafotze biyomei Tishrei. And he would take mats during the month of Tishrei in order to allow Tvila in the river. Again, he would allow Tvila in the river, but only with certain kinds of mats. Okay, that's called a mapatz. All right, let's go through all these three chumras, so to speak, that Avud Shmuel was noeg with regard to his daughters. Number one, lo shavik lehu yotzos bechutin. He did not allow them to go into Sarabim with the threads in the holes, the pierced ears. So the Gemara asks, for anan tnan habonos yotzos bechutin. Why couldn't Avud Shmuel rely on our Mishnah that permits it? And the Gemara answers, "Binase diavua dishmuel ditzivonim havu." In other words, they had special threads. Apparently, Avud Shmuel had some funds, and he didn't want them to walk around like shlumps, you know, just with threads hanging out their ears. So what he did was he commissioned an artist almost to make these beautiful red threads. Or colored threads, whatever the colors was. So they were multicolored, you know, the red colors of the rainbow. You know, that's what one of my students in America, he owns a factory for producing drapes. And the government wanted to close him down for the for this epidemic period. So he made a quick move, and he's now producing masks, and that becomes something critical for the American people. So the government allowed him to continue his manufacturing. So now he's manufacturing masks, and he's thinking about different kinds of colored masks that'll be very attractive, and people want to buy them. So if you're if you have your favorite sports team, so you'll probably commission someone to make that the emblem of the sports team on your mask. Anyway, so therefore, lo shavik lehu ginayon gabi adodi. Okay, so I think we may have, I may have skipped this from before, I'm sorry. Amongst the various minhagim of Avud Shmuel with regard to his daughters, one is that he was afraid that since they had these very fancy threads in their ears, they might take them off and show it to their friends and carry them. And the second thing is, lo shaviklu, he would not let them sleep one with the other. In other words, these were young girls. He didn't want them to sleep in a bed together. And we'll see why in just a split second. Lema misayele Rav Huna. This perhaps would support the statement of Huna. The Yom Rav Huna, nashim hamisololos zubazu. Okay, we're talking about women that if they sleep next to each other, perhaps without clothing on, or they may take off their clothing, then they'll come to some sort of a sexual pleasure that they might have one with the other. And if you turn now to Daf Samachem and Beis, we have a very, very extreme shita here of Rav Huna, psulos lekuhuna. That a Kohen is not allowed to marry a woman who is suspect, or maybe it's been proven that she behaves this way with other women. Now, a few comments over here. Comment number one is, you know, you could misinterpret this Gemara, and you could think that we're talking about any Kohen, that a Kohen is enjoined from marrying such a woman. That's not true. A Kohen is allowed to marry such a woman. The Kohuna here that's indicated by this statement of Rav Huna is a Kohen Gadol. And the reason for this is because a Kohen Gadol is not allowed to marry a Be'ula. The Torah says, "Vehu isha bipsuleo yikach." He's only allowed to marry a woman who is considered a besula, meaning as far as any sort of sexuality, any sort of involvement, engagement, she was never engaged in that way. That's the special holiness of the Kohen Gadol. And Rav Huna made this gzeira, in which he said that a Kohen Gadol should not marry a woman who, again, she may be still a besula, but she's had this kind of a, shall we call it a sexual escapade, and she's no longer considered pure for a Kohen Gadol. And this is all rabbinic. This is not a Doraisa halacha. Even in the case of a Kohen Gadol, she's still a besula. And Rashi and Tosfos deal with the following question. Rav Huna lived by far after the Churban HaBayis. So there was no Kohen Gadol. And Avud Shmuel for sure lived after the Churban HaBayis. So why was he so machmir? But the very fact that this is impurity, as far as the Kohen Gadol is concerned at the time of the Mikdash, that itself is indicative of the fact that this kind of behavior pattern has to be avoided. And Avud Shmuel took all the precautions to make sure that his daughters would not fall into that kind of a temptation. The Gemara says, Lo savar ki hechi de lo lelfan gufa nuchra. The Gemara says, you don't have to attach Avud Shmuel to the principle of Rav Huna. We don't have to go that far and say that a woman who has this pleasure from the body of another woman, therefore she cannot marry Kohen Gadol. But what we could say is that kind of behavior could arouse a woman to sexual desire, and then she might come to have a relationship with a man. And again, that's what Avud Shmuel wanted to avoid at all costs. Okay, now we get to the main, the main challenging sugya for today. And that is why Avud Shmuel would not allow his daughters to go into the Euphrates River during certain months of the year, from Nisan to Tishrei, but rather he built them his own private mikvah. So just let me read to you a pasuk at the end of Parsha Shmini. The Torah, when it talks about tahara, the process of purification, it says, "Ach mayon uvar mikve mayim yeh tahar." So we have categories here called a mayon, a bar, and a mikve mayim. Okay, so I'm just going to leave this here for a moment, and we'll try to figure out what these categories are as we go through the Gemara. Now again, let's keep in mind that as far as a mayon mayim is concerned, which means it has its own source of water, like a spring or a river, so the Euphrates River, which bordered on northern Babylonia, was perfectly acceptable for tahara. That comes under this pasuk. And indeed, the daughters of Israel, when they had to go to the mikveh in Babylonia, that's where they went. So what's the problem of Avud Shmuel? What's that all about? So the Gemara analyzes this. The Avud lay mikveh, he made his own mikveh. Mikveh is kind of a digging into the ground of a hole in the ground of certain size, and the rainwater would collect in that hole in the ground. Misayele l'rav. This minog of Avud Shmuel is predicated on a principle of rav. Diyomar rav, mitra bimarava, sahada rava pros. If you wanted to know whether or not there was a lot of rainwater in the Euphrates called the Nahar Pras, then all you had to find out was how much rain fell in Eretz Yisrael. So if there was a very rainy season in Eretz Yisrael, like Baruch Hashem we have this year, a very rainy season, then that's testimony that the Euphrates River is overflowing with rainwater. There's likewise lots of rainwater in Bavel, in the Euphrates River. So it's like overflowing. Savar, Avud Shmuel is worried about the following possibility. Shema Yirbu Hanotfim Al Hazochalin. So there are two types of waters. There's something called Notfim and there's something called Zochalim. The Notfim are the rainwater. And the Zochalim are the flowing waters of the river. And he's worried during these months of the year, Avud Shmuel's worried, that there's a rove, there's more rainwater than there is natural river flowing water. Now, you might ask me, so what? What's the problem with rainwater? So as we said before, there are two types of mikvos here that are relevant to us, and they have to be contrasted. They're really two categories that don't overlap. One is what we call the mayon, a spring, the Torah calls it. And the other is a mikveh. Now, the difference is that a mayon, which is a natural spring, as opposed to mikveh, which is a gathering of water. And that water, of course, could be rainwater. However, there's one fundamental difference between the two, and this is what we have to learn. In the case of a mayon, for Tara, it is fine even while it's flowing, whereas a mikveh has to be mikveh. Mikveh means gathered in one place. The water doesn't flow from one place to another. So when you talk about zochalim, which we said is the flow of the water, that's a mayon, that's a natural body of water, and that's fine for mikvos, for tvila and tara. Now, in the case of rainwater, which we said is a mikveh mayim, that's a gathering of water, that has to be stationary. So we have the following. Let's say you have springs, natural springs, and they flow into a river. That could be used for tvila, for tara, even though it's flowing, even though it's zochalim, as opposed to, as we said before, rainwater, which is called mikveh mayim. Now, what happens if you have rainwater that falls into a natural flowing spring? Like, for example, during these months, starting with Nisan and on, you have a tremendous amount of rainwater that falls into a spring. Now, a spring is kosher for a mikveh for tara, but that's only if its water flows naturally. If it flows because of the carrying of rainwater, it no longer has that status. So it's mimarevshach, meaning once you get to the point where although you're jumping into a river, but you're jumping into rainwater, and the water is flowing, so normally if not for the rainwater and this abundance and great volume of rainwater, that would be perfect. You're jumping into a flowing river, and that's what the Torah calls a mayan. A mayan, by definition, flows. And in this case, it flows into a river, and the river continues flowing. That's fine. But the problem is, you don't have a mikveh here. Because a mikveh means that you dig a hole, and you gather the water together, and it's stagnant in one place. Now the stagnant water of the rainwater is falling into the river, and you're going to jump into that point, at that location, where there's a massive volume of rainwater. And rainwater now disqualifies a mayon mayon. And Avud Shmuel was afraid that during these months, there's such a massive amount, a volume of rainwater coming down, that the rove is mevata lemiut. And even though there's a mixture here of flowing river water, which is considered mayon, together with mikveh water, but it's not a mikveh, he was afraid that the tefillah would take place in the rainwater. Now, it could be that deep down below the surface, maybe there's no rainwater, but at least on the surface, there's a lot of rainwater. And therefore, that rainwater disqualifies the mayon, and now the mayon could no longer be metayerha. So what did he do? He actually built his own mikvah, and he dug into the ground, the rainwater collected in the ground, and that's already called a mikvah mayon. Upliga the Shmuel, interesting. The son of Avur the Shmuel, in this case, disagrees with his own father. The Omer Shmuel, Nara Mikefe Mivrach. That is always going to be a bracha, Mivrach, a bracha that a river will increase and have more water than the rainwater. And we don't have to worry about the possibility that the overabundance of rainwater will be rov keneged the river and the natural water that comes from the springs. Not only that, the Gemara says, upliga di day adi day. Shmuel himself seems to contradict himself. Di Omar Shmuel, Shmuel is committed to the following position, ein hamayim mitarim bezochalin, that flowing water is not kosher as a mikveh to be metayer and purify someone from contamination, ela pras biyomei tishrei bilvad, except for the Euphrates River, because during this period of time there's a limited amount of rainwater. In other words, Shmuel himself seems to say that he is worried, just like his father was worried, about 6 months out of the year when there is an abundance of rainwater. So we have the first statement of Shmuel that says, Nara mi kefe mivrach. And we can always assume that there's a rove of flowing natural river water. On the other hand, we see that Shmuel himself disqualified the river during 6 months out of the year. He only accepted it be May Tishrei when there was a limited amount of rainwater. And it's interesting, the Gemara doesn't offer any sort of reconciliation of the two statements of Shmuel. Again, I would comment that maybe the first statement was just reflecting his father's view, I mean the second statement, and the other statement was reflecting his own view. It's possible. Porefes al ha'evan. Now we're talking about a woman taking a stone and using it as a kind of a button to fasten her cloak. And if she doesn't do this on Shabbos, she doesn't tie down the stone on Shabbos, she did it on Erev Shabbos, the stone is now designated as a button, and it's permissible. So Gemara asks the following question. Va'amrit Reisha Porefes. The Mishnah in the Reisha says that she's allowed to fasten it, and yet the Mishnah says that she's not allowed to fasten it. Omer Abaye, Seifa Ason Limatbea. We have to differentiate between the two cases. The Reisha is talking about one case, and the Sefer another case. And the Sefer is a coin. And in the case of a coin, we're not going to allow her to fasten it on the Shabbos itself. The coin is muktzah. In the case of a stone, which he uses or she uses for fastening as a button, this is not mukta. Why? Because they were designated on an ongoing basis to serve as a button. The coin was apparently used only occasionally, sort of like b'shas adchak, if she couldn't find a button or a stone or a nut. So this whole discussion here is all about being miyached, something that's normally mukta, for use before Shabbos. Boy Abaye, Isha Mao Shetarim Vitirfov Al Egos Lahotzi Libna Katan B'Shabbos. What happens if a woman wants to bring out to her child, who's out there and he's playing in the park, and it's in the Rishus HaRabim, a public domain, and she wants to bring out from Rishus HaYochid a nut so the child will either eat the nut or play with the nut? Can she use it as a button on her cloak, and she really has no intention of, or no need for it, but she's doing it in order to bring out something into Rishus Harab? And this is called Harama. Tarim is the conjugated verb of the noun Harama. Harama means to circumvent the law. And the question is, and this is a major machlokes all over Shas, whether or not we allow Harama. The Gemara says the following, Tiboy l'man diomer ma'arimin, and Tiboy l'man diomer ein ma'arimin. Abai thinks that his question will apply, equally be valid, according to both opinions, whether you hold in general you're allowed to find a way of circumventing the law, or those who say, no, we don't allow you to circumvent the law. How so? Tiboy l'man diomer ma'arimin. Even according to the Man Yomer who says that you're allowed to circumvent the law, and this is a case of Bidleika, there's a fire, and he has a bunch of clothing that's about to go up in smoke, and the only way he could save them and salvage them is by bringing them into his private house. But he's got to go through Rishus Harab. And one Man Yomer says, Ma'arimin. He can put on one pair of garments and another pair of garments, and he's going to carry it out, even though he really has no need for these garments other than to save them from the Dleika. And why would then the case of the egos of the nut be permissible in one side in the Suffolk of Abaye? Hasam, who there we have to prohibit it. Why? De'i lo sharisle. I'm sorry. There, we're going to Man Yomer who permits it. There, we're going to permit it. Why? To Elo Sharisle. If you don't allow him to take out his clothing in that way, by wearing them, is Asi Lichabuye. He may be so overwhelmed by the loss of all of his garments that he'll come to actually extinguish the fire. And that's why we're going to allow Haroma. Aval Hachir, here in our case where she fastens a nut to her cloak, if we tell her that she's not allowed to do it, she's not going to violate any other Torah law. You know, it's not that crucial for her to bring out the nut to her child that she would come to carry it on her own, in her own hands. Oh, Dilma, what should we say? Just the opposite. Even if we accept the opinion that there's no allowance to circumvent the law in a case of a fire and wear all these clothing, hasam, they're the reason why we don't want to allow it, is because derech hotzah b'kach, this is a way that's normally used for transporting. This we learned, if you remember, when we were studying the sugya of Dovr Sheino Meskaven, in the case of Mochrei Ksus, there were people who would sell shatnez to the goyim, and they would wear them as clothing, one on top of the other. So therefore, what we're worried about is that if she puts on one article of clothing on the top of another, that is derech hotzah. And there's a real issue here that there might be a violation of a doraisa, because this is called derech hotzah. It's the normal way you transport something. Aval hacha, but here in the case of tying a nut down to a strap around the cloak, is ein derech hotzah b'kach. That's not the way you carry a nut from one place to the other. And therefore, in the worst case scenario, there's no violation of derech hotzah, v'doraisa. Ein meshaper, though perhaps we could be more lenient and permit her to use this kind of circumventing the law and fastening onto a cloak. And the Gemara answers, teku. And this becomes an unresolved issue. Now, I just want to make a comment here. We're not learning Hilchos Shabbos, we're learning Masechta Shabbos. But there is an issue in the poskim about taking a key. Again, in my youth, we didn't have an Eruv. It's hard to believe, because those who live in my neighborhood, Flatbush, the 50 Eruvs. But anyway, in my childhood, we didn't have an Eruv. So we needed a key. So there were various possible solutions, but one of them, if you remember, was to make out of the key
a belt, you know, to attach the key to your belt. And the reason why we were mekil is because the assumption was that since it was really functioning to hold up his pants, therefore, you know, it was considered part of the belt.
That's not the derech how you make a belt, is it?
Right, but it might be derech hotzah, but on the other hand, it's not like the case of a nut where why would she use this kind of thing unless she was really carrying it out? But at some point, if it becomes acceptable and functional in that way, then it could be mutter. So I'm just saying the belt might be more mutter than the case of the nut. Let's just start the Mishnah, because tomorrow's daf. Oh boy. If you thought Samach Dalet was hard, wait till you see Samach Vav. Okay, so let's just at least get a head start. We have a few seconds. Hakatia yotze bekavshalo. A person who doesn't have a leg, and you add a prosthetic leg, and the question is he allowed to wear this? Now, Rabbi Meir quoted first in this Mishnah, allows it. And if you take a look on Daf Samach Vav, the Hemshech HaMishnah quotes Rabbi Yossi Oser. Now, we really have to know what's going on here, because you could read this Mishnah and come to a very, very wrong conclusion. Because what was common back in those days, for the sake of someone who didn't have a foot. So what he would do is, as Rashi explains here and elsewhere, he would carve something out of a piece of wood, and it would look like a foot. I mean, not that it was, you know, a perfect resemblance of a foot, but this particular kav that we're talking about, kav meaning a foot, a wooden foot, is not for purpose of supporting the weight of the body. Nobody argues that if you have something where he can actually put the weight on his body on this, and we'll talk about canes and things like that, that would be mutter. Here, he can bear the weight of his body with something that could be strapped to the bottom of his leg, but now we're talking about something that is an aesthetic helpful kind of thing. In other words, he's trying to conceal the fact that he doesn't have the leg, and they used to carve out this kind of a resemblance of a leg. But again, I have to emphasize, as you know, as we learn this tomorrow, Mitzvah Shem, that we're not talking about something that would support his foot. And then the Mishnah says, "V'im yeshlo beis kibul ksisim tome." What they used to do is, they used to carve out in this replacement foot a hole, sort of like a cavity, and that cavity would be stuffed up with something soft. Let's say they would use cotton or different rags and so forth and so on, which would make it more comfortable for him when he wore it. And at that point, even though it's made of wood, and as we've discussed on various occasions, pshute kli'eitz are not makabel tuma. A wooden utensil is only susceptible to tuma if it has a base kibul, if it has a receptacle. This is called a receptacle, and therefore it becomes susceptible to tuma. Okay then, so Berlin Eder, tomorrow we'll continue with this Mishnah. Now,